Welcome to this episode of Constitutional Quandaries, where we dive deep into the heart of legislative processes and examine the very fabric of our nation's legal backbone, the United States Constitution. I'm your host, here to guide you through a thought-provoking journey as we explore the intricate world of congressional bills and their constitutional implications. Today, we live in a society where legislation is not just a matter of governance, but a reflection of our values, aspirations, and yes, sometimes our conflicts. At the core of our discussions is the question, how do these bills align with the Constitution, the supreme law that all our laws must adhere to? It's not just about legality, but about the impact these bills have on the everyday lives of citizens. To give you a sense of the breadth and depth of our analysis, let's consider some numbers. Our team has meticulously analyzed approximately 14,732 bills and delved into roughly 143,927 pages of legislative text. Of these, we have identified approximately 7,494 bills that raise constitutional concerns. These numbers are not just statistics. They represent the pulse of our legislative body and the potential impact these decisions could have on the nation. In today's episode, we will focus on 8 of these bills, each chosen for its significant implications on constitutional law and its potential effects on citizens' everyday lives. We aim to illuminate the complex interplay between legislative intent and constitutional mandate, bringing clarity to an often opaque process. Joining us in this intellectual exploration are 2 seasoned experts who will provide us with contrasting perspectives on each bill. First, we have the proponent, who will argue in favor of the constitutionality and benefits these bills provide to the American people. Their perspective will highlight how these legislative efforts are designed to align with constitutional principles while addressing the needs and aspirations of our society. On the other side of the debate, we have the opponent, who will challenge the constitutional validity of these bills. Their focus will be on identifying potential conflicts with the Constitution and the possible adverse effects these legislative measures might have on our rights and liberties as citizens. The goal of our discussion is not simply to debate for the sake of argument, but to engage with these crucial issues at the intersection of law and life. The U.S. Constitution is more than a historical document. It is a living framework that guides and shapes our governance. Our exploration today will not only question the alignment of these bills with constitutional mandates, but also consider their broader implications on society. We invite you, our listeners, to engage with these discussions, consider the arguments presented, and reflect on how these legislative measures could shape your rights, your opportunities, and your future. This is not just a legal debate, but a conversation about the kind of nation we want to be and the values we want to uphold. Thank you for joining us on this journey through the labyrinth of legislative processes. Let's delve into the heart of the matter and see where the Constitution leads us.
Today, we're examining Senate Bill 4066, titled The Safeguarding Women from Chemical Abortion Act, introduced by Senator Josh Hawley. This bill is currently in the introduced stage and aims to withdraw federal approval for mifepristone, a key medication used in chemical abortions. It also introduces a federal tort, allowing individuals to sue the manufacturers of these drugs. The most affected groups include women of reproductive age, adult women seeking abortions, and particularly Black women, who may face compounded barriers in accessing healthcare. AI analysis indicates a negative impact on these groups, particularly in terms of their access to reproductive healthcare. The constitutional concerns raised involve the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause and the 5th Amendment's Due Process Clause. These concerns are centered around the bill's potential to restrict individual rights to privacy and bodily autonomy and the legal barriers it could create to accessing medical care.
Senate Bill 4066 is constitutional and necessary for safeguarding women's health. The bill focuses on the state's interest in protecting potential life and women's health, which the Supreme Court has recognized as legitimate under the 14th Amendment. By withdrawing federal approval for mifepristone, the bill aims to prevent potential harm associated with chemical abortions, aligning with the state's responsibility to safeguard public health. The introduction of a federal tort not only provides additional legal recourse for harmed individuals, but also upholds the 5th Amendment's Due Process Clause by ensuring accountability and transparency in the pharmaceutical industry. For women of reproductive age, this means a safer environment where the risks associated with medication are thoroughly vetted and addressed. The bill does not infringe on constitutional rights, but rather reinforces them by prioritizing safety and informed consent.
The constitutional issues with Senate Bill 4066 are glaring. By withdrawing approval for mifepristone, the bill effectively limits women's access to a legal medical procedure, infringing on their right to privacy as protected by the 14th Amendment. This withdrawal disproportionately affects women, particularly Black women, exacerbating existing healthcare disparities. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment is at risk here, as the bill discriminates against women by imposing additional legal and medical barriers that do not apply to men. Furthermore, the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause is compromised, as the bill could lead to excessive litigation, deterring healthcare providers from offering necessary reproductive services. This could create a chilling effect, further restricting access to healthcare for women who urgently need it.
Addressing the concerns about discrimination in healthcare access, Senate Bill 4066 is not about excluding women from healthcare, but ensuring their safety. The bill is grounded in the principle that states can regulate medical procedures to protect patients. The potential for litigation is not a deterrent, but a mechanism for accountability, ensuring drug manufacturers prioritize safety. While it's true that the bill affects women, it does so with the intention of safeguarding their health, which aligns with the state's duty under the 14th Amendment. The bill does not violate due process. Instead, it seeks to prevent harm by ensuring thorough scrutiny of the drugs used in abortions. This is about informed consent and protecting lives, not restricting rights.
The argument that this bill is about safety does not hold when it results in reduced access to essential healthcare services. The withdrawal of mifepristone's approval without clear evidence of harm ignores the established medical consensus on its safety and efficacy. This approach undermines the due process guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment, as it deprives women of their right to make informed decisions about their health. The legal burdens introduced by the bill are likely to deter healthcare providers, limiting the availability of reproductive services, especially for marginalized groups like Black women. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment is jeopardized as this bill imposes unequal burdens on women, suggesting that their healthcare needs are secondary to political agendas.
In closing, Senate Bill 4066 is about prioritizing safety and ensuring that all medical procedures, particularly those as consequential as abortions, adhere to the highest standards. The bill respects constitutional boundaries by allowing states to exercise their rights to regulate healthcare in the interest of public safety. The accountability measures introduced are not intended to deter, but to ensure that manufacturers are held responsible. This is not an infringement on rights, but a reinforcement of the principle that healthcare should be safe and reliable. For women, this means being assured that their health is protected by stringent regulations that promote well-being over convenience.
Thank you both for your insights on Senate Bill 4066. As we move forward, our next discussion will focus on another pressing issue within the legislative landscape. Stay with us as we examine the implications and constitutional concerns of our next bill.
Today, we turn to H.R. 7981, the Stop Secret Counseling of Students Act, sponsored by Representative Ana Paulina Luna of Florida's 13th District. The bill is currently in the introduced status. This piece of legislation aims to prohibit public elementary and secondary schools from offering counseling or guidance concerning gender identity to students under 18 years of age. The legislation emphasizes parental rights and permits parents to take civil action against schools that contravene this prohibition. According to the AI analysis, adolescents, particularly female adolescents, are negatively affected by the restrictions on counseling, as it limits their access to supportive resources during critical developmental stages. The bill raises significant constitutional concerns, particularly under the First Amendment, which protects free speech and access to information, and the 14th Amendment, which ensures equal protection under the law. These restrictions could lead to a chilling effect on mental health resources for minors, impacting their well-being and autonomy. The debate centers around whether this bill infringes on the rights of students to receive necessary support and whether it disproportionately affects certain groups, potentially leading to increased stigma and mental health challenges.
The Stop Secret Counseling of Students Act is a necessary measure to ensure that parents retain their fundamental rights to oversee their children's upbringing and education. The bill aligns with the 10th Amendment, which reserves powers to the states and the people, including parents, when not delegated to the federal government. This bill empowers parents by giving them recourse through civil actions if schools attempt to bypass parental authority in sensitive matters such as gender identity counseling. From a constitutional perspective, the bill does not infringe on the First or 14th Amendments because it does not prevent students from accessing information altogether. Rather, it ensures that parents are involved in these critical discussions. In the real world, this bill safeguards families by reinforcing the role of parents in guiding their children's development, particularly adolescents, who are still navigating complex personal identities. By involving parents in these conversations, the bill fosters a supportive environment where families can address these issues together, ensuring the well-being of adolescents.
While parental involvement is important, H.R. 7981 oversteps by infringing on the rights of adolescents under the First and 14th Amendments. The First Amendment protects not only free speech, but also the right to receive information, which is essential for students exploring their gender identity. Restricting counseling services effectively silences a critical avenue of support for these students, especially female adolescents who are disproportionately affected. The 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause is also at stake, as this bill could lead to discrimination against transgender and non-binary students, increasing stigma and mental health challenges. The real-world impact on adolescents, particularly those who might not have supportive home environments, is a significant concern. By preventing schools from providing necessary guidance, the bill could lead to adverse mental health outcomes, limiting students' ability to develop their identities in a safe and informed manner.
It's important to note that the bill does not completely eliminate access to information or support for adolescents. Parents are key stakeholders in their children's development, and the bill seeks to enhance family engagement by ensuring parents are informed and involved in their child's exploration of gender identity. The 10th Amendment supports this approach by emphasizing the role of state and parental rights. Furthermore, the bill allows for a collaborative approach between parents and schools rather than a unilateral decision-making process by educators. This involvement can lead to more tailored and supportive environments for adolescents, addressing their needs while respecting parental rights. While concerns about the bill's impact on mental health are valid, it is crucial to recognize that the bill aims to balance these concerns with parental rights, ensuring a holistic approach to adolescent development.
However, the reality is that many adolescents, particularly those struggling with gender identity, might not find the support they need at home. H.R. 7981 assumes an ideal scenario where all parents are supportive and informed, which is not always the case. The restrictions on school counseling could leave vulnerable students without any safe space to discuss their identities, exacerbating mental health issues. The First Amendment rights of students to access information and the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause are crucial here. The bill's approach potentially marginalizes students who do not fit traditional gender norms, creating a hostile environment. Moreover, the legal risks for schools could lead to a chilling effect, where educators avoid any discussions about gender identity out of fear of litigation, further isolating these students. The constitutional implications are significant, as the bill could be perceived as state-sanctioned discrimination against a minority group, undermining their rights to equal protection and access to information.
It's crucial to emphasize that H.R. 7981 is not about denying support, but about clarifying responsibilities and roles. The bill encourages a partnership between parents and educators, which can lead to more comprehensive support for students. The 10th Amendment underscores the importance of parental rights in guiding children's education and upbringing. By ensuring that parents are involved, the bill seeks to create a more inclusive and informed environment for adolescents. While the concerns about student autonomy and mental health are valid, the bill provides a structured approach to these sensitive topics, inviting parents to be part of the solution. This collaborative dynamic can help bridge gaps and foster understanding, ultimately benefiting the adolescents in question. The bill does not preclude discussions about gender identity. It merely ensures that parents are aware and involved, which can enhance the support network available to students.
As we've seen, H.R. 7981 raises complex questions about the balance between parental rights and student autonomy. We'll now move on to our next bill, examining further constitutional debates surrounding education and individual rights.
Welcome to today's discussion on H.R. 7983, the Clean Water for All Life Act, sponsored by Representative Mary E. Miller from Illinois. Currently, the bill has been introduced but not passed. It seeks to implement restrictions on chemical abortions by mandating the presence of a healthcare provider during the procedure. This legislation has significant implications for women's reproductive rights, specifically affecting their privacy and bodily autonomy. According to AI analysis, this bill could severely impact women seeking reproductive healthcare, especially in rural and underserved areas where access to healthcare providers is limited.
The bill raises constitutional concerns, primarily with the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the 9th Amendment regarding rights retained by the people, and the 5th Amendment's Due Process Clause. The potential for creating legal barriers to accessing reproductive health care is at the heart of the debate today. Let's delve into whether this bill aligns with constitutional mandates and its real-world impact on women's health care access.
The Clean Water for All Life Act is a necessary step in ensuring the safety and well-being of women seeking chemical abortions. By requiring the presence of a healthcare provider, the bill ensures proper medical oversight, reducing risks associated with these procedures. From a constitutional standpoint, the bill does not violate the 14th Amendment or any other provision. Instead, it aligns with the state's interest in protecting health and safety, a principle upheld in Planned Parenthood v. Casey. The 9th Amendment allows for the implementation of reasonable regulations that protect citizens' health, and this bill falls within that scope. Women, particularly those in underserved areas, will benefit from this legislation because it guarantees a level of care and monitoring that safeguards their health during a critical medical procedure. While opponents claim it restricts access, the bill simply ensures that access is safe and medically supervised.
The Clean Water for All Life Act poses severe constitutional violations by imposing undue burdens on women's access to reproductive health care. The requirement for a health care provider's physical presence during chemical abortions is an unnecessary barrier, particularly harmful to women in rural and underserved areas. It infringes on the right to privacy and bodily autonomy, as enshrined in Roe v. Wade and upheld through Planned Parenthood v. Casey. The 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause is at risk, as this bill disproportionately affects women who already face challenges in accessing health care. Furthermore, the 9th and 5th Amendments are implicated, as the bill strips away rights retained by the people and due process protections. By criminalizing the provision of chemical abortions without a provider present, H.R. 7983 could lead to increased penalties for healthcare providers and further reduce women's access to necessary medical care. This bill is not about safety. It is a thinly veiled attempt to curtail reproductive rights.
While concerns about access are valid, it's crucial to emphasize that the bill's intention is to enhance safety, not restrict rights. The 14th Amendment permits states to regulate medical procedures in the interest of safety. Past court rulings, such as Planned Parenthood v. Casey, recognize that states have a legitimate interest in safeguarding health. This bill provides a framework for ensuring that chemical abortions, which can have significant health implications, are conducted with appropriate medical oversight. The presence of a healthcare provider ensures that any complications can be swiftly addressed, ultimately protecting women's health. The 9th Amendment's allowance for reasonable regulations supports this measure as a balanced approach rather than an infringement. It is about ensuring that women receive the highest standard of medical care, which in the long term will benefit them significantly.
The notion that this bill enhances safety is misleading and fails to address its broader implications on women's constitutional rights. The undue burden standard established in Casey makes it clear that laws creating substantial obstacles to abortion access are unconstitutional. This bill does precisely that by imposing unnecessary logistical hurdles, particularly for women in areas with limited healthcare access. The requirement does not consider the practical challenges women face in securing appointments with providers, especially in regions where healthcare is sparse. This is a clear violation of the Equal Protection Clause, as it disproportionately impacts women based on their geographic and socioeconomic status. The 9th Amendment protects against such overreach by the state, ensuring that rights not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution are still safeguarded. By enforcing this bill, we risk undermining the very essence of reproductive rights and equal protection under the law.
It's important to clarify that this bill does not aim to obstruct access to reproductive health care, but to ensure it is conducted safely and effectively. The Constitution does not prohibit states from enacting measures to protect health. The bill's requirement for a healthcare provider's presence is a practical measure designed to prevent medical complications during chemical abortions. While access issues are a concern, the bill encourages the development of healthcare infrastructure in underserved areas, indirectly improving access over time. The 9th Amendment supports such regulations, as they align with the general welfare of the populace. This legislation seeks to strike a balance between access and safety, ultimately benefiting women by providing a secure and regulated healthcare framework.
Thank you both for a thorough discussion on H.R. 7983. As we've explored, the constitutional implications and real-world impacts of this bill are complex and deeply contentious. Let's now move on to our next bill and examine its constitutional considerations.
Today we are examining H.R. 7902,
titled The Safeguarding Women from Chemical Abortion Act, sponsored by Representative Diana Harshbarger from Tennessee. This bill, currently introduced, aims to withdraw federal approval for the drug mifepristone, a medication commonly used for terminating pregnancies. The legislation also introduces a federal tort, allowing individuals to sue for harm claimed from chemical abortion drugs. The groups most affected by this bill are women seeking reproductive health care, who face a significant negative impact due to the restrictions imposed. The AI analysis highlights that this bill raises substantial constitutional concerns, particularly around individual rights, such as the right to privacy, equal protection, and due process, as outlined in the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the 9th Amendment's right retained by the people, and the 5th Amendment's Due Process Clause. The debate today will focus on whether this bill's provisions infringe upon these constitutional rights, with potential legal challenges arising due to its limitations on reproductive healthcare access.
The Safeguarding Women from Chemical Abortion Act is both constitutional and necessary for protecting women's health. The bill aligns with the state's rights under the 10th Amendment, allowing them to regulate medical practices and protect their citizens. The bill's intention to withdraw mifepristone from federal approval is grounded in concerns for safety and well-being, ensuring that women are not exposed to potentially harmful medications without proper oversight. By introducing a federal tort, it provides a vital recourse for individuals who have suffered harm, thus reinforcing their right to seek redress, a principle embedded within the 7th Amendment. This bill is a response to mounting evidence about the risks associated with chemical abortions and ensures that the due process rights of women are upheld by offering them a legal pathway to claim damages if harmed. Additionally, this legislation respects the federalism principle by not preempting state laws, allowing states to make more localized decisions about health care that best suit their populations. Ultimately, this bill is not only constitutional, but also a prudent step towards safeguarding women's health.
The Safeguarding Women from Chemical Abortion Act is a direct violation of constitutional rights, particularly infringing on the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause and the 5th Amendment's Due Process Clause. By withdrawing federal approval for mifepristone, the bill effectively denies women access to a legal and safe medical procedure, infringing on their right to privacy as established in Roe v. Wade. The introduction of a federal tort that allows for lawsuits based on perceived harm from chemical abortions places unnecessary burdens on healthcare providers and could deter them from offering these essential services, thereby limiting access and creating a chilling effect. This bill's provisions can lead to increased health risks, as women might resort to unsafe methods due to restricted access to safe and regulated medications. Furthermore, the 9th Amendment, which protects the rights retained by the people, is undermined as this bill disregards the established rights of women to make private medical decisions without undue government interference. By failing to respect these constitutional protections, the bill poses a serious threat to women's reproductive rights and health.
While the concerns about access to reproductive health care are valid, it is important to consider the safety and legal protections this bill offers. The federal tort provision is not meant to burden healthcare providers, but to ensure accountability and safety standards are met. Women deserve the right to pursue legal action if they suffer from the adverse effects of these medications, which is consistent with the legal principle of seeking redress for grievances. As for the privacy concerns under Roe v. Wade, it's crucial to recognize that this bill does not ban abortions, but rather ensure safer medical practices are followed. The 10th Amendment supports the state's power to regulate medical practices, ensuring that medical procedures are safe and effective. Moreover, the bill respects the state's rights to legislate on these matters, allowing states to create frameworks that reflect their population's values and needs. This does not infringe on constitutional rights, but rather strengthens the federal structure by empowering states to act in the best interest of their citizens.
The argument for safety and accountability does not justify the sweeping restrictions imposed by this bill. The withdrawal of mifepristone's federal approval severely limits women's access to a safe and legal reproductive health care option, violating the right to privacy and due process as enshrined in the Constitution. This bill's reliance on state regulation can create a patchwork of access where women's rights vary drastically from state to state, undermining the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The 9th Amendment also supports the retention of rights not explicitly enumerated, such as the right to make private medical decisions without excessive government intervention. The introduction of tort claims may seem protective, but in reality, it opens the door to frivolous lawsuits that could discourage healthcare providers from offering necessary services, thereby harming women's healthcare access. This bill not only challenges established legal precedents, but also threatens the health and autonomy of women across the country.
It's essential to balance the protection of individual rights with the need for safety and accountability in medical practices. The Safeguarding Women from Chemical Abortion Act seeks to ensure that women have the legal means to address grievances and that healthcare providers maintain high standards of care. While the bill might create disparities in access due to state-level decisions, it also respects the federal structure that allows for localized governance, a principle supported by the 10th Amendment. This bill is not about denying rights, but about ensuring that when rights are exercised, they do not come at the cost of safety and due process. The federal tort provision is aimed at providing a safeguard for women who genuinely suffer harm, thereby reinforcing their rights to legal recourse. By focusing on safety and accountability, the bill ensures that women receive the best possible care without compromising constitutional principles.
As we conclude our debate on H.R. 7902, the Safeguarding Women from Chemical Abortion Act, it's clear that the constitutional implications are deeply contested. We now turn our attention to the next piece of legislation on our docket, exploring its potential impact and constitutional validity. Stay with us.
Today, we turn to House Bill 7874, titled the Mail Ballot Integrity Act, sponsored by Representative Clay Higgins of Louisiana. Currently, this bill has been introduced but not yet passed into law. The primary aim of this legislation is to enhance election security by regulating the distribution of mail-in ballots. It seeks to prohibit unsolicited ballots, requiring voters to actively request them. However, this raises significant constitutional concerns, particularly regarding the right to vote, equal protection under the law, and due process as outlined in the Voting Rights Act, the 14th Amendment, and the First Amendment. The groups most affected include seniors, Hispanic, and Black voters, who could face increased barriers to voting. The AI analysis indicates a potentially negative impact on these demographics, particularly seniors, who may find the additional steps burdensome, thus leading to disenfranchisement. The bill's emphasis on election integrity must be balanced against the risk of restricting voter access and the constitutional implications therein.
The Mail Ballot Integrity Act is a necessary step toward securing our elections, which is a fundamental responsibility of the states under Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution. This section allows states to determine the times, places, and manner of holding elections, which includes the method of distributing ballots. By requiring voters to actively request their mail-in ballots, we ensure that ballots are only sent to those who intend to vote, reducing the risk of fraud. This is not an infringement on voting rights, but a safeguard against electoral manipulation. For seniors and other affected groups, the bill does not prevent them from voting. Rather, it ensures the security of their votes. While the bill might introduce additional steps, it is a reasonable trade-off for maintaining the integrity of our democratic process. Moreover, states can implement these measures with careful consideration to minimize undue hardship on any voter group.
While election security is important, the Mail Ballot Integrity Act introduces unnecessary barriers that infringe upon constitutional rights. The 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause mandates that all citizens have equal access to voting. This bill's requirement for voters to request mail-in ballots disproportionately affects seniors, Hispanic, and Black voters, essentially obstructing their access to the electoral process. Additionally, the Voting Rights Act protects against discriminatory practices that impair the ability of minority groups to participate in elections. By making it more difficult for these groups to vote, the bill could be seen as a form of voter suppression. This is not just a theoretical concern, but a practical one. Many seniors and those with disabilities rely heavily on mail-in voting due to mobility issues. The added administrative burden could lead to inadvertent disenfranchisement, violating both their voting rights and the spirit of equal protection under the law.
The concerns you raise about disenfranchisement are valid, but they overlook the flexibility that states have in implementing these measures. Article 1, Section 4 gives states the authority to make accommodations for voters who face difficulties in accessing voting systems. The bill does not prohibit states from offering assistance to those who need help navigating the request process. Moreover, the legislation provides an opportunity for states to innovate in how they manage voter rolls, ensuring they are current and accurate. This not only enhances election integrity, but can also help prevent the disenfranchisement you mention. It's essential to remember that the goal is not to restrict voting, but to ensure that only eligible voters participate, thereby safeguarding the democratic process for everyone, including seniors and minority groups.
While states do have some discretion, the practical implementation of these measures can result in significant barriers. The bill's requirement for voters to actively request their ballots could deter participation, especially among groups already facing obstacles. The 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause and the Voting Rights Act exist precisely to prevent such unintended consequences. Seniors and minority voters may not have the same access to the resources needed to comply with these new regulations, effectively silencing their voices in the electoral process. Rather than enhancing security, this bill may inadvertently create a two-tiered voting system where certain groups face higher hurdles to participate. It's crucial to consider the real-world impact and potential legal challenges that could arise if this bill were enacted without sufficient safeguards for vulnerable populations.
It's crucial to address these potential challenges with careful legislative action. The bill's intent is not to disenfranchise, but to protect the electoral process. States have the means to implement supportive measures, such as public awareness campaigns and assistance programs to help voters navigate the changes. Article 1, Section 4 is clear in its delegation of responsibility to states to manage elections, and this bill falls within that constitutional framework. By ensuring that mail-in ballots are requested, we can better protect against instances of fraud or mismanagement. The integrity of our elections is paramount, and this legislation is designed to uphold that integrity while still respecting the rights and needs of all voters. With thoughtful implementation, the bill can enhance security without disenfranchising vulnerable groups.
This concludes our discussion on the Mail Ballot Integrity Act. As we've seen, the balance between election security and voter access is delicate, with significant constitutional implications. Our next segment will explore another bill with potential impacts on civil liberties. Stay tuned.
Today, we examine Senate Joint Resolution 189, introduced by Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. This resolution proposes an amendment to the U.S. Constitution aimed at redefining citizenship criteria. Specifically, it seeks to limit citizenship to individuals born in the United States to parents who meet certain criteria, effectively excluding those born to non-citizen parents. According to the AI analysis, this bill could negatively impact infants and children born to non-citizen parents, potentially denying them citizenship. The constitutional concerns center around the 14th Amendment's Citizenship and Equal Protection Clauses, as well as the 5th Amendment's Due Process Clause. The resolution raises serious questions about the potential creation of a subclass of individuals denied citizenship based solely on their parents' status, which could lead to significant legal challenges and affect families nationwide. Let's delve into the constitutional and societal implications of this proposed amendment.
The proposed amendment under Senate Joint Resolution 189 stands firmly on constitutional grounds. The 14th Amendment Citizenship Clause was intended to address the specific historical context of former slaves, post-Civil War, not to provide a blanket guarantee of citizenship to anyone born on U.S. soil. The resolution clarifies this clause, ensuring that citizenship is granted to those with a demonstrable connection to the nation through their parents. This is not merely constitutional, it is necessary for maintaining the integrity of U.S. citizenship. By aligning citizenship criteria with modern realities, we protect the rights of citizens and ensure fair application of the law. Infants and children born to non-citizen parents would benefit in the long run, as the amendment encourages legal immigration pathways, providing a clearer, more secure future for those who are citizens. This is about safeguarding the rights and privileges of citizenship for those who are truly connected to the country. This resolution directly contradicts the clear language and intent of the 14th Amendment. The Citizenship Clause was designed to establish an inclusive definition of citizenship, ensuring that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are recognized as citizens. By imposing additional criteria based on the status of parents, this bill undermines the principle of equal protection under the law, as guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. Moreover, it poses a severe risk of discrimination, particularly against children of non-citizen parents, creating a second-class status that contravenes the Equal Protection Clause. Infants and children who are born in the U.S. deserve the same rights and protections as any other citizen, and this resolution jeopardizes that fundamental promise. It opens the door to legal challenges that could destabilize long-standing citizenship principles and create confusion and hardship for countless families. It's important to acknowledge that the 14th Amendment does not explicitly define the scope of subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Senate Joint Resolution 189 seeks to clarify this ambiguity, a clarification that is long overdue. The amendment does not aim to discriminate, but rather to uphold the original constitutional intent, ensuring that citizenship is a meaningful, well-defined status.
This clarification prevents exploitation of the citizenship clause and aligns with the constitutional power of Congress to regulate naturalization, as per Article 1, Section 8. By tightening these criteria, the amendment encourages lawful immigration while preserving resources and opportunities for citizens and lawful residents. It is a proactive step towards a coherent immigration policy that supports national interests and protects the rights of all citizens. The proponent's argument overlooks the broader implications of this resolution. By redefining subject to the jurisdiction thereof, we risk eroding a fundamental pillar of constitutional law that has stood for over a century. The Citizenship Clause, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, is clear. Birthright citizenship applies to anyone born on U.S. soil, regardless of parental status. This amendment's narrow interpretation not only conflicts with the 14th Amendment, but also the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause by denying basic rights to individuals based on arbitrary criteria. This proposal could destabilize the lives of infants and children, leading to statelessness and legal limbo, contrary to our nation's values of fairness and inclusivity. The potential societal and legal chaos is a cost too high to bear.
The resolution is not about creating chaos, but about establishing clarity and fairness in our citizenship laws. It is a measured response to modern challenges, ensuring that citizenship is granted to those with a genuine connection to the United States. This does not negate the principles of fairness or inclusivity. Rather, it affirms them by setting clear, equitable standards for all. The amendment respects congressional authority to define naturalization processes while aligning with the nation's current needs. By encouraging lawful immigration and preventing misuse of the citizenship clause, the resolution strengthens the integrity of our immigration system and ensures that resources are allocated justly. This is not a deviation from constitutional principles, but a necessary evolution to uphold them in today's context.
As we wrap up our discussion on Senate Joint Resolution 189, it's clear there are deep divisions regarding its constitutional implications and its impact on families. We'll now transition to our next topic, which addresses a different facet of citizenship and rights under U.S. law. Stay with us as we explore this pressing issue. Today, we delve into the contentious H.R. 8077, known as the 287G Cooperation Act of 2026. Sponsored by Representative Ben Klein, this bill has been introduced but not yet passed into law. It proposes that local law enforcement agencies enter agreements with ICE to receive federal funding for community policing initiatives. The bill's provisions demand cooperation between local police and federal immigration authorities, which raises significant constitutional concerns, particularly regarding the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause, the Fourth Amendment's protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, and the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. The groups most impacted include racial minorities and Hispanic communities, who face potentially severe negative effects, such as increased discrimination and fear of reporting crimes due to deportation risks. The critical question here is whether this bill violates constitutional rights by potentially enabling racial profiling and eroding community trust in law enforcement. Let's explore these constitutional and societal implications further.
The 287G Cooperation Act of 2026 stands firmly on constitutional ground and offers real-world benefits to affected communities. Under Article 1, Section 8, Congress has the power to establish uniform laws on immigration. The bill's requirement for local law enforcement to work with ICE ensures a cohesive national strategy for immigration control, crucial for national security and public safety. By securing federal funding, local agencies can enhance their policing efforts, thereby improving safety for all residents, including immigrant communities. This collaboration does not intrinsically violate due process or equal protection. Rather, it supports the enforcement of existing laws fairly and uniformly. Moreover, the bill provides local agencies the resources to better serve their communities, fostering trust through enhanced safety and the responsible application of immigration laws.
The proponent's view overlooks critical constitutional violations inherent in the 287G Cooperation Act. The bill invites racial profiling and discrimination against minorities and Hispanic communities, directly contravening the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. By compelling local law enforcement to act as federal immigration enforcers, it creates an environment ripe for abuses of the Fourth Amendment's protections against unreasonable searches. Moreover, the due process rights under the Fifth Amendment are at risk, as the bill potentially leads to expedited deportations without adequate legal representation. The societal harm is evident. Immigrant communities may become estranged from law enforcement, resulting in decreased crime reporting and a breakdown of public safety. The act thus undermines both constitutional protections and community trust.
It's crucial to address the opponent's concerns directly. The bill does not mandate racial profiling. Rather, it aims to streamline processes between local and federal authorities under existing immigration laws. Cooperation with ICE is not synonymous with discrimination. It is about law enforcement efficiency. The constitutional framework permits Congress to legislate in areas affecting national security and immigration. By facilitating a structured partnership, the bill ensures local agencies have the necessary resources to protect all community members effectively. Instead of undermining trust, this bill can enhance it by demonstrating a commitment to lawful and fair enforcement practices that protect everyone, including vulnerable communities, from crime and exploitation.
The notion that this bill merely enhances cooperation is misleading. The forced integration of local police with federal immigration efforts can erode the foundational trust necessary for effective community policing. The fear of deportation will deter many from seeking assistance or reporting crimes, particularly within Hispanic communities, thereby reducing public safety. The constitutional risk is palpable. Without stringent safeguards, the bill could lead to violations of due process and equal protection rights, as immigrants might face rushed legal proceedings without adequate representation. Furthermore, the Fourth Amendment could be compromised by encouraging warrantless detentions based on immigration status. This bill could indeed harm the very fabric of community relations and constitutional principles.
While the concerns raised are valid, they presuppose outcomes that the bill itself neither dictates nor endorses. The 287G Cooperation Act provides a framework for collaboration that can be implemented with respect for constitutional rights. The bill empowers local agencies with federal resources to address crime comprehensively, benefiting all residents, including minorities and immigrants, who deserve safe neighborhoods. It is incumbent upon local enforcement to apply these powers judiciously, ensuring no constitutional overreach occurs. The focus should be on proper implementation and oversight to harness the bill's potential for enhancing safety and trust through lawful and transparent practices.
Thank you both for your passionate arguments regarding the 287G Cooperation Act. As we reflect on the possible constitutional and societal impacts, it's clear this bill raises complex issues. Let's now shift our focus to the final bill on today's agenda, which also addresses pressing concerns about federal and local jurisdiction. Stay tuned.
Today, we're examining H.R. 8017, titled the Defeat Sharia Law in America Act, introduced by Rep. Barry Moore from Alabama. This bill has been introduced in the House and is currently at the discussion stage. The legislation seeks to amend the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by prohibiting public accommodations from implementing Sharia law. However, the AI analysis highlights significant constitutional concerns, particularly regarding the First Amendment's protection of religious freedom and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The groups most negatively impacted include Hispanic individuals and racial minorities, who may face increased discrimination. The bill could foster an environment of intolerance towards Muslim individuals, potentially leading to heightened scrutiny and legal challenges. The central constitutional question revolves around whether this bill unjustly infringes upon the free exercise of religion and whether it maintains equal protection under the law. Let's delve into this complex issue.
H.R. 8017 is a necessary measure to uphold the principles of equality and secular governance enshrined in our Constitution. The First Amendment protects religious freedom, but it does not allow for religious practices that could undermine public policy or civil rights. The bill does not target individuals based on their faith. Rather, it seeks to prevent specific legal systems, like Sharia law, from conflicting with American civil rights laws. This is consistent with the Constitution's goal of maintaining a separation between church and state. By ensuring that public accommodations adhere to U.S. laws, we protect all citizens from potential religious overreach that could infringe on their rights. The bill provides clarity and reinforces the fundamental principle that no religious law can supersede the laws of the land, thus benefiting all, including those potentially vulnerable to religious discrimination.
The claim that H.R. 8017 protects constitutional principles is deeply flawed. The First Amendment explicitly guarantees the free exercise of religion, and the 14th Amendment ensures equal protection under the law for all individuals. This bill unjustly targets Muslim Americans by singling out Sharia law, fostering an environment of discrimination, and hindering the religious freedoms of a marginalized group. By categorizing Sharia law implementation as religious discrimination, the bill invites legal challenges and increases scrutiny against ethnic and racial minorities, further marginalizing them. The AI analysis warns of the potential for this legislation to create precedents for more discriminatory laws, threatening the foundational ideals of religious freedom and equality that our nation is built upon.
The concerns about discrimination are understandable, but they miss the bill's intent and scope. H.R. 8017 doesn't attack religious practice. It ensures that any religious laws like Sharia cannot be used to circumvent U.S. civil rights protections. The bill does not prevent anyone from practicing their faith. It merely reinforces the supremacy of U.S. law and public accommodations. This helps protect individuals against potential impositions that could erode their civil liberties. The bill is not anti-Muslim. It is pro-equality, ensuring that everyone, regardless of their faith, enjoys the same legal standards. It's about maintaining a legal framework that respects all individuals' rights without allowing any religious law to undermine these rights.
Despite claims of neutrality, H.R. 8017 effectively targets one religious tradition, which contradicts the spirit of the First Amendment. The bill's selective focus on Sharia law can lead to increased discrimination against Muslims and other minorities, as highlighted by the AI analysis. Such legislative actions risk alienating groups and fostering intolerance, rather than promoting unity and equal protection. The Constitution protects against such discrimination, and any attempt to legislate against a particular religious practice must be scrutinized rigorously. Instead of reinforcing equality, this bill risks creating a legal environment where certain beliefs are stigmatized, potentially encouraging further discriminatory practices against religious minorities.
At its core, H.R. 8017 is about upholding the rule of law and ensuring that U.S. civil rights are not undermined by any external legal systems. While the bill mentions Sharia law, it sets a precedent that no religious laws can interfere with civil rights protections. This ensures that all citizens, irrespective of their religion, are treated equally under the law. The focus is on safeguarding civil liberties, not targeting specific communities. By reinforcing the separation of religious laws from public policy, we strengthen the constitutional framework that protects all faiths and promotes a secular, fair legal system.
This concludes our discussion on H.R. 8717. The debate underscores significant constitutional considerations and the potential societal impacts of the bill. Thank you to both our speakers for their insights. As we wrap up this series, let's continue to reflect on how our laws can balance individual freedoms with societal needs.
As we wrap up today's episode, let's take a moment to reflect on the recurring constitutional themes we've explored. Throughout our discussion of the various bills, several key issues have consistently emerged. Notably, questions about the separation of powers have been particularly prominent, especially in Senate Bill 4066 and House Bill 7981. These bills highlight the ongoing debate over the balance of authority between the legislative and executive branches, a cornerstone issue that remains as relevant today as it was at the founding of our nation. Another pressing theme has been the invocation of the Commerce Clause, often scrutinized in contexts where federal reach seems to extend into areas traditionally managed by states. The tension between individual freedoms and governmental regulations appeared frequently, especially concerning the First and Fourth Amendments. For example, House Bill 7983 brought to light critical conversations about freedom of speech and the potential overreach of government surveillance. The Fifth Amendment, with its due process guarantees, and the 14th Amendment, with its equal protection clause, also surfaced as points of tension, particularly in bills like House Bill 7902 and House Bill 7874. These amendments underscore the ongoing necessity to balance individual rights against broader societal goals. Among all the bills discussed, Senate Joint Resolution 189 raised the most serious constitutional concerns. It presents a profound challenge by potentially altering the balance of federal and state powers in ways that many constitutional scholars find troubling. The implications of this resolution could set precedents that might affect legislative processes and individual rights for generations. In plain terms, it could shift power structures in ways that affect both governance and personal freedoms. Real people affected by these legislative changes include families struggling to make ends meet, individuals relying on healthcare programs, and communities seeking to protect their local environments. The elderly, who might depend on social services, and young adults entering the workforce or education are also directly impacted by these bills. These are not just abstract legal debates, they have real-world consequences for people's daily lives. We encourage you, our listeners, to actively engage in this democratic process. Reach out to your representatives, let your voices be heard, and take the time to read these bills.
Staying informed is the first step towards ensuring that the legislation passed truly reflects the will and needs of the people. With knowledge comes power, and with power, the ability to effect meaningful change. Thank you for joining us today. We hope this discussion has offered you valuable insights into the constitutional debates shaping our laws. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and continue to question the world around you. Goodbye for now.